Well, Chair notes we don't quite have a quorum yet, so we will proceed anyway. I think we will hold off on, I'd like to go around and just have introductions of each other and our staff. So let's hold that in abeyance until we get the balance of our membership. We have members in the packet, a set of proposed rules by which we will operate as a committee. They're in your packets for your review. Pursuant to House Rule 6.21, I'll be submitting those to the Speaker on Friday and to each member of the House. If you have any input on those rules, please raise them now or at any time during our next two meetings this week. Committee, we want to have some agency overviews today, both of the public Board of Public Defense and the Department of Public Safety. Mr. Kier, are you here? Members, and also Mr. Kier, prior to your overview, I'd like you, since this House will be dealing with a deficiency bill later in the week, I understand on the floor you have a portion of that, and I would like you to present that first, if you will, and committee, so the committee can have questions. We will not be voting on anything as a body relative to the deficiency bill, but we will be hearing all elements of it this week. So, Mr. Kier, go ahead.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Kevin Kier. I'm the Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. In that deficiency bill, along with several other items, is an appropriation to the Board for $7,681,000. As most of you are aware, this issue first came up last spring, when there was a failure to act on that budget request or on that issue. The board was looking at laying off 140 attorneys around the state, or about 25 to 30% of our lawyer staff. Those of you who have practiced law and those of you who have been in the courtroom can imagine what that would have done to the court system. Over the course of the summer, the governor and the four leaders of the caucuses got together, sent letters to the chair of our board asking that we not take that action, that the board just remain at their fiscal year 2004 level, and that the legislature would reconvene in January and address that situation. And so that's pretty much where we are today.
Any questions at this time? Ms. Kier, go ahead. Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kier, where did the money come from?
Mr. Kier.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, where did...
We just spent future money or what?
Madam Chair and Mr. Chairman and Representative Murphy, right now we are running and spending at our fiscal year 2004 level. So in the event that no action is taken, we will run out of money.
When?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, we have projected right now we will start running a deficit probably the end of this month, maybe the middle of February, completely out. I'd have to take a look, but it's fairly soon. I'd have to go back and look again.
Representative Murphy.
I suppose we better pass that bill, Mr. Chairman.
I think so, Representative Murphy. Any other questions on this particular point? If you think of anything, Committee Representative Paymar.
So, Mr. Chairman, so the $7.6 million, so this is in part due to the ruling that the fee structure was unconstitutional. Is that part of this deficiency?
Mr. Kier.
Chairman, Representative Paymar, this is... a result of that decision, and then also, as most of you may recall, is Governor Pawlenty did recommend the restoration of that $7.6 million in his supplemental budget last year after that decision came down. And obviously, with the way the session ended last year, it just didn't get didn't get done or didn't get acted on. So,
Mr. Chair, how much was actually the result of the fees that were ruled unconstitutional?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kamar, all of it.
All of it.
Yeah.
Any other questions?
Costly mistake.
All right, Mr. Kamar, go ahead.
Chairman and members, for those of you who have been around for a while, I know a lot of this will be old hat, and maybe some of it, maybe not for all of you, but we'll go through, and we've done an outline here of the board, and then at the end, some of the issues and some of the things that we're facing over the next few years. The board is a judicial branch agency whose purpose is to provide quality criminal defense services to indigent Minnesotans through a cost-effective and efficient public defender service system. We have seven members, four who are appointed by the Supreme Court. Those are attorney members. Three who are appointed by the governor. The board's responsibilities include appointing the state public defender, the chief district public defenders in each judicial district, distribution of appropriations from the legislature, and setting standards and policies for the operation of our public defender offices. The organization is organized into three programs. We have the appellate office, the district public defense office, and our administrative services office. With the exception of one fairly large issue, there are no services that we provide that are either constitutionally or statutorily required. We do two things, basically. We provide trial-level services, and we provide appellate-level services. On the district public defense level, the board provides constitutionally mandated services in felonies, gross misdemeanors, misdemeanors, and juvenile cases. Statutorily mandated services to children over 10 years of old and 10 years of age in child protection cases. And as some of you have discussed in this committee in the past, we also are providing representation for parents in child protection cases, even though that's not a mandated service at this time. There are 10 judicial public defender offices, each of them headed by a chief district public defender. We have approximately 525 lawyers around the state that provide that service. About 60% of those folks are part-time, and I'm sure most of you have heard from them over the course of the last year or 18 months, especially in greater Minnesota. We are the largest customer of the court system. We handle about 165,000 cases a year. Estimates are somewhere between 80 and 90% of serious cases, felony and gross misdemeanor cases, are handled by public defenders. Somewhere probably around 50 to 60% of misdemeanor cases. The last time I was down in Ramsey County, which was about a year ago, in the court there, we sat through a calendar of 21 cases. Out of those 21 cases, 20 of them were public defender cases. And the one case that wasn't was a DWI case that a woman happened to work at, I think it was Winthrop and Weinstein or one of those higher buck law firms, and she figured she could probably get representation on her own. So some of you may have read of the recent Rice County situation where there were some immigration issues and some drug issues. I believe at the last count there were 70 indictments that were held that were out. There were 50 arrests made. Out of those 50, I believe we are up to 47 right now, public defender cases out of those 50. We had another situation over in Winona County where we had, I think, 20 or 21 cases, you know, similar percentages. So as we get into those more serious things, they're pretty much all public defender cases, with some exceptions. The important thing for us, Mr. Chairman and members, is the public defender system cannot control its workload. We do not control that. It's controlled by outside forces. Folks sitting around this table are obviously a big one. As sentences are increased, or more crimes are enacted. The police and prosecution patterns across the state. I mentioned the gang strike forces Rice County situation. That was another one. Obviously, we don't control those. Sentencing guidelines changes, court decisions, a big one which you folks will be dealing with, the Blakely decision, another situation where we don't control those inputs.
Yes.
The other issue relative to the control of caseloads is a series of Supreme Court decisions. The most frequent, or I should say the latest one, is Zubiak v. Mott. In Zubiak, the court essentially said that once assigned, public defenders cannot refuse cases, even if they have a high caseload, despite their caseload. Now, so not only do we not control the input, now once we have the input, we also don't control the ability to take those cases or move those cases around, at least someone. What that bumps up against, and we will talk a little bit about it later in the issues that we have, is our attorneys are still held by the Lawyers Professional Responsibility Board to the same ethical standards that private lawyers are. And obviously in the case of the part-time lawyers, they are private lawyers. So that creates some conflict for us, and I want to talk a little bit about that later on. Also, Mr. Chairman and members, in the area of district public defense, we have 5 public defense corporations that the board provides funding for. These corporations handle about 5,000 cases a year that would otherwise be public defender cases. They leverage the state dollars we give them, leverage about, for every dollar, they leverage a dollar in private resources to enhance those budgets. For the most part, these corporations predated the Board of Public Defense, and as I said, it's another 5,000 cases that we don't handle that we otherwise would have to handle. Our appellate office, where we have right now currently 26 and a half full-time equivalent lawyers out of that 525 that I talked about, handles all criminal appeals, post-conviction proceedings, parole revocation proceedings, and the sex offender community notification and review hearings, some of you refer to as the end of confinement review hearings. The other big issue that now has come up is the issue of Blakely. And for those of you who are not familiar, in a case Blakely v. Washington, the United States Supreme Court basically said that upward departures from a guidelines sentence must be considered by a jury and not a judge. Right now, that case is retroactive to another case that was decided in 2001, which is Apprendi, what our estimate right now is, going back that far, is somewhere between 300 and 500 of these cases we will see. If it goes back further than that, and there are some cases working their way through the system right now that indicate that may be the case, we could be looking at 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 of these cases. Again, that's in still a Supreme Court issue that they're still trying to grapple with. On page 8 of the handout, I just did want to have you take a look at some of the caseload situations in the appellate office. And what we've done here, and on page 9 of the handout, is to do a couple of graphs comparing some of the caseloads over the last year with the DOC inmate population. And on page 8, what you can see is a huge increase in those end of confinement review hearings, or sex offender notification hearings, if you will. We have about a 60% increase. We have over 20% increase in the appeals area, and a similar increase in the parole revocation hearings. If you turn to page 9, what you will see is tracking those parole revocation hearings and those appeals along with the adult inmate population at the Department of Corrections. As you can see, those lines track almost identically. Despite all of that, over the course of the last 10 or 12 years, the number of appeals or the percentage of appeals that we actually file has remained fairly constant, around 40% of the total. So we are doing a number of screenings to see if there are merits to each of these cases as they move forward. And that's been pretty constant, as I said, over the last 10 or 12 years. Our administrative services office is our last one. We provide all of the human resources, accounting, payroll, information systems, all of those things you generally think of as kind of central administration functions. There are 12 of us in the office that do that. Actually, we're down to 11 right now that do that. We run about 3% of the budget. Right now we have 5 information system staff that run a system that serves 700 people in 28 different offices, maintaining asset tracking, email, virus protection, all of those things that you know, we kind of all take for granted a lot of times when we flip that computer on in the morning. In addition, a huge part of their time right now is being spent on the conversion from TSIS to MNSIS, and you're going to hear a little bit about that in our budget request. But basically what we're trying to do is convert our basically 10-year-old systems, make them compatible with MNSIS so that we can capture all of the public data that somebody's already entering, so that we don't have to have another public employee entering that same data. And so we're able to pull it down, and obviously saving an awful lot of keystrokes and an awful lot of time. Issues and priorities. Chairman, obviously it starts on page 11. Obviously in no particular order, with the exception of maybe the first one, is funding. And those of you who have been on the committee for a while, and I think some of you who haven't, understand that we have a crisis in public defender funding. We have a situation where we have extremely high caseloads. We have part-time public defenders right now who are putting in excess of the hours that they committed to. Last year, about 29,000 hours. Secondly, is child protection cases. There is no question that these are important cases, and we consider them to be. But we have a lack of resources to commit to these cases. Right now, we get multiple clients out of these cases. We average probably about 1.7 appointments per case, when you figure in not only the children, but also the parents that we're representing. As I've said before, it's a non-mandated service, and what we've seen over the last several years is a couple of things. One is there are federal timelines, especially on out-of-home placements, and some of you are much more familiar with this than I am, there are federal timelines that start as soon as that petition is filed in court. In addition, the Supreme Court's Children's Justice Initiative, which basically sets a protocol for these cases and establishes kind of a best practices, has now spread to all 87 counties. And there's no question that it's a laudable goal, and it's something that we should look to achieving. We just don't have the resources to deal with all of those demands that we have. And again, in the budget presentation, you're going to be hearing something about just how extreme that is and what kind of a situation we have there. Suffice it to say that right now we did 2 separate studies with the Supreme Court a couple of years ago. We did an analysis of this. They came up with an analysis that said we needed 64 new lawyers around the state to do this work. Our analysis came up that we needed 66 new lawyers to do this around the state. So as you can see, they weren't far off. Caseloads and hours, as I mentioned, is putting a very difficult strain on our public defenders, particularly in greater Minnesota, where we have, as I mentioned, a number of part-timers. What we're finding is the demands of public defense are really crowding out people's ability to have a private practice. And I'm sure some of you from those areas have heard that from some of your local public defenders. What we've seen is a number of folks who have resigned or cut back from their caseload because they just are not able to keep up. And one of the things that ends up happening, because of the way we fund this and because of the way we pay these folks, we end up losing experienced lawyers. So we not only lose our experienced lawyers, but the other side of the coin is we're having a very difficult time trying to recruit people to go to those areas for part-time public defense work because it's not worth their time to do it. And so we're caught in a very difficult situation, which over the next 5 or 6 years will be really become acute, as we have a number of folks who are right now in their low to mid-50s and are going to be looking at retiring from this work. And so we just are not going to have the people that are going to be able to replace them. And frankly, it's a concern of ours and has been for some time. We're looking at some ways to address it, some incentives for people to take this kind of work out in those areas. But it's difficult, and I'm not sure what we can do about that. Another issue that we're all facing, which you folks I know have been facing, is meth cases. And from talking to our public defenders, this is an epidemic. And I guess I'm not telling any of you folks anything new. I'm sure you've heard it from your law enforcement people and your prosecutors as well. It is unbelievable what has gone on, particularly in those counties outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul, Hennepin, and Ramsey County. In our case, we often get multiple defendants. For some reason, folks who make meth have to do it with 7 or 8 of their buddies. I haven't quite understood why they have to do that, but they do. Right now, a typical situation we had in Brainerd actually this fall, where we had a meth case where we picked up 8 co-defendants. The next day, we got another meth case where we picked up 9 co-defendants. We have 4 lawyers in Brainerd, so obviously we've got to bring folks in from all over to address these issues and to handle those cases. The other thing we're seeing a lot more of right now is child protection cases that are coming out of these cases. Typically what happens is, you know, an arrest is made, the meth is being manufactured in the garage or in the basement, there are children in the home, they're moved to out-of-home placement, and then we start with a CHIP situation. I know the last report that I saw, there were 2 counties that I saw, one was Pine County and the other Crow Wing County, that last year spent combined $2.5 million on meth-related costs, on meth cases. Now, a large portion of that was for foster care for out-of-home placement. But those are 2 relatively small counties, especially Pine County. And so I can't imagine what it is going around the state, but those are the 2 that I saw. The other thing that we're seeing quite a bit with in the meth cases is the associated cases that come with that. Burglary, bad checks, all the typical things that come with drug and alcohol abuse, we're also now starting to see with meth issues. Another issue is technology. I touched on that a little bit. Obviously the big one is the conversion to Mensis, and that will be a very important one over the course of the next few years. The other issue technology-wise is the costs that are being driven by technology, and I'll give you one example. Right now we're struggling with electronic discovery, getting discovery from the prosecutors in electronic format rather than a paper format. And we're all for it, and we want to be able to cooperate with folks, and we want to be able to do this. But the counties, in particular some of the bigger counties, are so far ahead of us resource-wise, they're able to do a lot of this, and we don't have the resources to convert, to have the software, the printers, and all the other things that go along with sending photographs electronically, video electronically, all the other data that has to come across our desk electronically. We also are struggling right now, as I said, with the part-time public defenders because they don't have obviously access to those kinds of that kind of equipment and software in their law offices, and especially in greater Minnesota, that's a real issue for us. So, Mr. Chairman, finally, is sex offender cases, both at the trial level and the appellate level, at least the notification hearings. I'm reasonably sure that you all are going to enact some kind of tougher sentencing on sex offenders this session. I think that was one of the things I think most folks agreed about last spring. The number of cases involved here, the complexity of these cases, the psychological exams, the DNA analysis, my public defenders are telling me that the increase in sentences in this area could have, and again I say could have the same if not a greater impact than the death penalty on our system, basically because of those scientific issues that are involved and the sheer number of cases that will be involved. I will remind members, and I've said this in the past, our board has never taken a position against, with the exception of the death penalty, has never taken a position against increasing sentences. What the board has always been very concerned about is if there are going to be those increases, that somehow they're paid for. And I know that's a difficult situation that you all are facing, but that's where our board has been over the years, and I don't see that changing dramatically. As I said, we've seen a huge increase in those community notification hearings. The other piece of the community notification hearings that we have been seeing is those clients who are involved in those wanting to exhaust all of their remedies as that designation of level 1, level 2, level 3 now has more consequences. And so not only are we seeing more of these hearings, but we're seeing many more of these hearings exhausting all of the remedies or going through all of the process. Chairman, I know that was rather quick, but I know you got public safety here and a pretty full agenda, so at that point I guess I'd stand for any questions.
Any questions at this time? Representative Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Kier, could you talk about, if you'd like to, how certain changes might either increase or reduce the caseload and therefore free up public defender services? For example, how do mandatory minimum sentences impact public defender services? How would something like mandatory statewide diversion for first-time low-level drug offenders affect your caseload? Care to take any...
Mr. Chairman, let me take a stab at one piece, then I'd like to have Bill Ward, who is our chief public defender in the 10th District, come down and talk a little bit maybe about the diversion and some of those. 3 years ago, 2 years ago, we worked with the Conference of Chief Judges and Chief Judge Lynch out in Dakota County and brought a bill. They brought a bill forward to turn a number of misdemeanors into petty misdemeanors. That bill obviously didn't go anywhere. But right now we handle about 65,000 misdemeanor cases a year. The potential impact of that bill might have been, 15,000 or 20,000 cases. That's fairly significant. Although you got to remember, on the misdemeanors, obviously those are the ones that take the least amount of time. In Hennepin and Ramsey, we've seen kind of a leveling off of misdemeanor cases, and in some cases there's a trend that actually there are a reduction. And I think what's happened there is, in those two counties, the chief judges have a schedule of petty misdemeanors that they've implemented. On the other side of that, what we've also seen now is an increase in felony cases and also an increase in juvenile cases. So they're kind of balancing out. But in terms of the diversion of the mandatory minimums, I guess if Bill, if you got it, or John, one of the two, would want to come and talk a little bit about that.
Good morning.
Have a seat at the table and give us your name for the record.
My name is William Ward. I'm the chief public defender of the 10th Judicial District. Mr. Chair, Ms. Ellison, mandatory diversion would be helpful for us. We find that in a couple of the counties in the 10th District that do have diversion, it helps get rid of cases earlier on in the process. obviously by diverting those cases early, there's less time that the attorneys need to handle or spend time with those clients. The burden becomes and falls upon the client to follow through with the diversion program, to follow through with recommendations from the corrections department, including drug and alcohol treatment, that sort of thing.
Mr. Ward, excuse me, could you pull your microphone closer to your mouth?
Certainly.
Thank you.
We have found that having diversion has been very helpful to the point where in the PIC counties, Pine, Isani, Kanabec, and Chisago, we're trying to deal with the local bench as well as the county attorneys to try and institute a diversion-type program there as well. Rex Tucker is the managing attorney for those counties, has been working on that for the last several months. The constraints we have is whether or not the local prosecutors want to have a diversion program. They believe, and I understand their position, that they have a number of eligible programs to try and divert cases early. And unfortunately, the requirements to be a part of this program are sometimes very stringent in order to get a person into a diversion program. And that's been somewhat of the reluctance we've been finding in many of the counties in the state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Ellison.
What I have in mind now, thank you for that. I'm thinking that in the case where a person has a prior felony conviction and is caught with a firearm, regardless as to whether or not when they get caught with a firearm, whether or not they're committing a violent act, if they are caught felony conviction with a firearm, and of course you know very well that the predicate offense could be an offense like fifth-degree controlled substance, even as a juvenile, you know, in some cases, that's a 5-year mandatory minimum sentence. And that means that clients are going to trial. Why not? You're going to get 5 years if you win the trial. You're going to get 5 years if you lose a trial. How do you think those kind of mandatory minimum sentences affect public defender time?
Mr. Ward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ellison, I believe mandatory minimums have some problems of their own. I came from a mandatory minimum state of Illinois. I practiced there for 14 years. And what happens is a lot more people go to prison, and there's also a lot more court time that's taken up to deal with those types of cases. As you state, there's nothing to lose. If they have a prior, maybe the same level of offense, the client knows that, yes, in fact, if she or he loses their case, they're going to prison. So they have nothing to lose by going forward and having trials. What mandatory minimums tend to do is put more people in prison and takes more time in the system itself to prepare for these cases and actually try these cases.
Thank you.
Very good. Any other questions? Representative Johnson, and then Pimar. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kyer, what's the eligibility requirement in Minnesota for someone to have a right to a public defender?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, let me just back up one step. Is the state public defender is responsible for developing the eligibility criteria, which he then sends to the court, and the court is instrumented in that. In statute, and I forget the citation right now, there's a list of the eligibility criteria. It basically is if you are eligible for a means-tested government benefit, that you are eligible for a public defender.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Kyer, do you know offhand how we compare to other states in general with respect to the means testing?
Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Johnson, I don't write offhand. I'd have to take a look there. It seemed to me there were some things. I know Wisconsin was a little different, but it's the idea of the eligibility and what's in statute and what's in the rule and what's actually in practice are often two different things, so it's kind of hard to compare, you know, county to county, let alone state to state. So,
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Kyer, I have a question on the deficiency bill. The money that you were asking for the appellate office, you know, part of that had to do with the Blakely decision. And you're estimating that your office may see 4,000 additional cases. But if you read the report to the Minnesota from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and they seem to have a different position on that, and that this likely really won't be deemed retroactive, and therefore you'll have a very nominal amount of cases. So, just wondering where you're getting that 4,000 cases.
Mr. Chairman, Kier. Representative Paymar, I don't think anybody knows on the retroactivity yet. And that's what I'm saying. Is right now, going back to Apprendi, we're looking at that 300 to 500 that I talked about. I think we've got a, at last count, I think we had 175 so far. And that may be wrong, but it's right around there since whenever the Blakely decision became public. So the question is, we had one, there had been a trial judge in southern Minnesota that declared it was retroactive to 81, then 1980. In that case, if that were to then become the standard, obviously we'd have several more than the 4,000. So I don't think anybody really knows yet until the Supreme Court clarifies that.
So, Mr. Chair, so the
Representative Paymar.
So the request then was based on what?
On
supposition?
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Paymar, on the 300 to 500.
On the 300 to 500. Thank you.
Other questions? Very good. If you're done.
Thank you.
Sky, are you going to be in the room for the balance of the hearing? Will you be in the room for the balance of the hearing?
I can be.
Why don't you hang around? Again, committee, this it's my intent, and this is our opportunity to question Mr. Kier relative to the public defense portion of the deficiency bill. So if you have additional questions, today would be the time to answer and get them asked and get them answered. Thank you. And next on our agenda would be the Department of Public Safety, Commissioner Michael Campion, Deputy Commissioner Mary Ellison. If you'd identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, good morning. Michael Campion is my name. I'm the Commissioner of Public Safety, and with me is Mary Ellison, Deputy Commissioner of Public Safety.
Commissioner, we would want just a general overview today for the Department of Public Safety, but also specifically since we're taking up the deficiency bill and it contains a portion at your request, I'd like you to address those couple of items first.
Be more than happy to, Mr. Chair. First, I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members for the opportunity to come early before you in the session for this overview. We will do our best to provide you an efficient and effective overview. Our intention is for me to make some very ever so short comments, and Deputy Commissioner Ellison will do the bulk of the overview. We have our division directors available to answer additionally any questions that any of the committee members may have. The mission of the Department of Public Safety is really quite simple. We provide Minnesota with a safe community to live and work in, and we do this by promoting or through a series of activities: prevention, preparedness, response, recovery, education, and enforcement. Our primary activities, and we accomplish this through a series of activities, focusing on saving lives, providing efficient and effective services, maintaining the public trust, and I think probably most of all, developing very strong partnerships. With that, I would ask Deputy Commissioner Ellison to continue with our overview.
Deputy Commissioner Ellison, it's good to see you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Nice to be here again today. As the commissioner mentioned, our main mission really is to protect Minnesotans with a commitment to excellence and to promote safer communities. We have several core functions that we provide: enforcing liquor and gambling laws, conducting criminal investigations and forensic science analysis, administering driver and vehicle services, coordinating emergency planning and response for disasters and acts of terrorism, promoting fire safety, ensuring safety of natural gas and hazardous liquid pipeline systems, enforcing traffic laws on Minnesota highways, promoting safety on roadways and reducing traffic injuries and fatalities, providing financial advocacy and assistance for victims of crime, administering justice assistance and crime prevention grant programs, and administering the state 911 program. Just to give you a few, just at a glance, statistics of some of the things that we're involved in. We provide over 270,000 vehicle registration renewals and payments via self-service in our driver vehicle services. 4,958 DWI arrests were made by the State Patrol in 2003. 15,521 cases were examined by the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. We fund more than 375 locally based crime victim assistance programs and provided, through those activities, provided services to over 190,000 individuals in fiscal year 2004. We conducted 475 fire investigations during 2003, and 203 of those were determined to be arson. We have 9 different operational divisions within the Department of Public Safety, and they include alcohol and gambling enforcement, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, driver and vehicle services, Homeland Security and Emergency Management, the State Fire Marshal and Pipeline Safety Office, the State Patrol, Traffic Safety, the Office of Justice Programs, and 911 Emergency Services and Armor. All the budgets, with the exception of Driver and Vehicle Services, State Patrol, and the Office of Traffic Safety, are heard in front of this committee. The total budget that is heard in front of this committee this past year totaled $275 million, and we had 500 full-time equivalent positions within the Department of Public Safety. With that very brief overview, I'll open it up to questions and address any issues in the deficiency budget that you would like addressed.
Could you, Deputy Commissioner Ellison, would you just give us a quick summary? The numbers I'm looking at are the $276,000 for continuing the operation of the gang strike force and the $710,000 matching federal disaster assistance money. Could you explain those two items for us?
Yes, I'd be happy to talk about the gang strike force in particular, and then I would ask Dale Battaglia to come down and talk about the disaster assistance match program. The governor is requesting $276,000 to keep the operations of the criminal gang strike force intact through June 30th of this year. That will allow the bill that was heard last year to combine the operations of the task forces and multi-jurisdictional narcotics task forces to be heard again in front of the legislature and a decision made prior to July 1st.
Okay. On that particular point, any questions from the committee? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Ellison, are we talking about the gang strike force or the gang and drug strike task force?
Commissioner Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, we're talking about $276,000 specifically for the criminal gang strike force.
Representative Murphy.
And Mr. Chair, what is the funding status then of the drug task force?
Commissioner Ellison.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the multi-jurisdictional narcotics task force is to continue to receive federal grant dollars.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Ellison, in the same amounts that they were receiving before or in increased amounts?
Commissioner Ellison.
Or decreased amounts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, in the same amounts as they have been in the past.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Ellison, then after the deficiency bill is passed, is there another appropriation request then for the gang strike force merger after July 1, 2005?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's a little delicate because the governor's budget hasn't come out yet, so we can talk about that as soon as the governor's budget comes out, but I can tell you that certainly was a priority for him last year and continues to be a priority.
And so until July 1st, or June 30th, 2005, we're talking just about the gang strike force.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, that's correct.
Thank you.
Other questions? Who else did we have then on the FEMA?
Mr. Battaglia, if you would come forward and talk about the deficiency request.
Good morning. For the record, Al Battaglia, Director of the Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management within the Department of Public Safety. The $710,000 deficiency reference is related to FEMA disaster 1569, which occurred in southern Minnesota as a result of heavy rains on September 14th and 15th of 2004. It impacted the counties of Martin, Faribault, Freeborn, Mower, Steele, Dodge, and Olmsted. The FEMA share of this disaster declaration is 75%, and the non-federal share is 25%. The programs requiring funding on the individual assistance side, which is individual homeowners, is 25% match required on the state. That's $300,000. There's a mitigation program requirement of 25% match over 3 years, which is $35,000. The public assistance side of the house, which is damage to public property, is $675,000 for a total of $1,010,000. Of that, we have encumbered $300,000 in support of that, leaving a deficiency of $710,000 for this specific declaration.
Mr. Battaglia, will there be any more money needed or necessary to address this particular disaster for which this money either has or has been spent or is being spent? Will there be any more money needed to assist in this particular disaster?
Mr. Chair, at this point in time, we have entered into 147 sub-grant agreements with the applicants, and there are no more out there, so these are the final figures for 1569.
And again, Mr. Battaglia, how much federal money does this leverage, this amount that we're looking at?
Could you restate that question?
You may have already answered this. How much federal money does this $710,000 leverage or acquire?
75% greater than that. This declaration came in at approximately, if you can just bear with me, Mr. Chair. $5,137,000, of which the state share is $1,010,000.
Any questions from anyone else on the committee? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any more questions for public safety in general? This is, again, a general overview to help get our feet wet or re-wet them, and we'll be looking. We'll be inviting Commissioner Campion to join us again down the road.
Look forward to it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for the opportunity, members.
I think we have no further overviews. I would like to take a couple of moments to. We have some new members, and we also have some new staff, and pending staff changes, so I would like to simply go around the room, and we're just going to do it like you did in school and start down there at the end of the table. Tell each other who we are, and when we get to the representatives, you can feel free to tell us how much airtime you want and on what specific bills at this time, and we'll take that under advisement. I'm kidding, Ms. Fisher.
Chairman Smith and members, my name is Tracy Fisher. I'm the GOP Research Consultant for Public Safety Committee, as well as Civil Law and Elections and the Ethics Committee.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For those of you who do not know me, my name is Scott Newman. I am from District 18A. By profession, I am an attorney. This is my first year on this committee, and I look forward very much to serving with you. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I am Representative Judy Soderstrom from District 8B, which includes like Mora, Pine City, Hinckley, Sandstone, and it's my second term on this committee.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Tony Cornish, representative from 24B, the Faribault, Blue Earth, and Waseca counties, and a retired law enforcement officer.
Jeff Johnson from Plymouth. I'm starting my third term, and I am a lawyer as well.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Becky Perius. I'm a new analyst at House Research. I will be covering the areas of courts, DWI, and crime victims.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Jeff Diebel. I've served on the committee for the last 4 years. This will be my fifth session, and I'll be staffing issues related to public safety, corrections, and sex offender drafting. There are also two analysts in House Research that will be supplementing our Becky and I, and those are probably familiar to most of you. One is Jim Cleary, and he is primarily responsible for Veteran Affairs, which is conflicts with this committee, so he won't be in committee much, but he is a statewide expert on DWI law, as well as our primary point person on firearms. And then also Judy Zoller is an analyst in our office that will be working about half-time on criminal justice issues, and she will be she won't be staffing committee, but she will be helping in any sex offender proposals, which she's a statewide expert on sex offender law and policy, and someone that you should feel free to contact with any questions on that. We've also put into your packets two documents. One is a document that lists our subject matter, so it'll be a cheat sheet for you to contact us if you have a specific question on a specific area in public safety within this court, within this committee's jurisdiction. Our numbers are on there, and as well as some discrete subjects that we cover. And then there's also a list of publications that House Research has submitted to for public disclosure that you can access through the website, and they're very helpful to members, as well as if you want to send them to constituents if they have questions. They're often useful background for them to learn about the law and for you to respond to their questions.
Before we go further on the table, we've skipped the page. We have a new page. You stand up. I'm going to embarrass you. Give us your name and... Very good. Thank you, Mike. Mr. Carger.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Gary Carger. I'm the fiscal analyst for the committee. And we also put some information in the packet. It's the blue pages. It's simply staff assignments from our department and some budget and fiscal information, sources of information, and also some of the publications.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Kevin Matzik. I'm the committee administrator for the Public Safety Policy Finance Committee.
All right. I'm Representative Steve Smith. My district is 33A. I live in Mound, Minnesota, and my district is contained entirely within Hennepin County, the west end, basically west of Lake Minnetonka and north of that down to the Wright and Carver County lines.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Dave Anderson. I'm the Committee Legislative Assistant for the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Representative Rob Eastland. I am from District 17A, beginning my third term, my second term on this committee, and I look forward to its enjoyable committee.
I'm Deborah Hillstrom. I'm a state representative from District 46B, that is all of Brooklyn Center and parts of Brooklyn Park. That's a first ring suburb of North Minneapolis. This is my third term in office, as well as my third term on this committee, and I look forward to continuing to serve you.
Good.
I'm Alice Hausman. I represent the neighborhoods in the northwest portion of St. Paul, the Midway area, Como Park, St. Anthony Park, and the city of Falcon Heights.
Keith Ellison. I represent House District 58B, which is North Minneapolis and the intersection of downtown. And I really enjoy serving the committee, and I'm in my second term.
I'm Michael Tamar. I represent some of the western neighborhoods of St. Paul, and I've been on this committee since 1996, except for a short, brief time when Chairman Stanek was chairman.
Very good. Very good. I think we have a couple of members who can supply their hopes and dreams and personal information at our next meeting. Committee, that's all of our business today, but just bear in mind that we will be looking at the deficiency bill that you've heard about on the floor sometime later this week. We will have additional presentation tomorrow, and if you have any questions that arise on what information we've had today that you need additional information, just let me or my committee administrator know, and if we need to have any of the witnesses back that we've had today, we'll be happy to do that. There's nothing further today than this meeting is adjourned.
Mr. Chair.
Whoops. Hold that in advance. This meeting is not adjourned.
Mr. Chair, if it would be... Oh,
sorry. No, go ahead. I'm waiting for another member. Go ahead. Okay, Representative Hillstrom.
Mr. Chair, if it would be possible to get a copy of the spreadsheet for the new members so they can actually see the deficiency bill that many of us have heard previously, it would be nice to have some numbers to look at.
We will do that, I think, either by the next meeting, which is tomorrow, or whether we can get it done before, we'll get it to you prior to that.
Thank you.
Representative Murphy, we had just gone around the table and done our introductions. Would you care to join us?
Ma'am.
Oh, yes. Governor. Mr. Chair, I'm Representative Murphy. I live in Hermantown, and this is my 87th year on this committee in one form or another. I didn't always have public safety, but I've always had corrections since the early 80s.
Well, Representative Murphy, I still have a sign outside my door, at least for the next year and a half, that says judiciary, policy, and finance. And I like the word judiciary. Apparently, some folks are calling us public safety at this point. But I think you and I have worked on this committee together longer than anyone else, and I'm looking forward to your help. And
I remember your dark hair as well as you remember mine.
Thank you. This meeting is adjourned.